It's time once again for the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, John Curry. On the program today, we'll be hearing pieces from the Disability Scoop, the Braille Monitor, and other sources as well. Also, as you'll hear in our first piece, October is National Disability Employment Awareness Month. In recognition of that fact, each of our programs this month will include an article highlighting the value of people with disabilities in the workplace. Our first installment, which we'll hear later in the program, is a piece from the Harvard Business Review. To kick off today's program, here's a news release from the U.S. Department of Labor. Department of Labor announces Access to Good Jobs for All as National Disability Employment Awareness Month 2024 theme. Annual commemoration in October celebrates contributions of workers with disabilities. Washington. The Department of Labor today announced that its Office of Disability Employment Policy has chosen Access to Good Jobs for All as the theme for National Disability Employment Awareness Month, which will be observed in October. NDEAM annually celebrates the contributions of the nation's disabled workers and showcases supportive, inclusive policies and practices that benefit employees and employers alike. Our theme in 2024, Access to Good Jobs for All, speaks to our commitment to expand the number of employment opportunities for people with disabilities and the quality of those opportunities, explained Assistant Secretary for Disability Employment Policy Taryn M. Williams. Good jobs change lives, and all workers, including disabled people, deserve the opportunity to prepare for success in high-quality, good-paying jobs in workplaces free of discrimination. In 1945, the nation first designated a national week to recognize the contribution of people with physical disability. Designated by Congress as NDEAM in 1988, the commemoration evolved to acknowledge the importance of increasing the number of people with disabilities in the workforce. In 2001, ODEP was created and was given responsibility for NDEAM and for selecting and helping promote its annual theme. And now that piece from the Harvard Business Review entitled Disability as a Source of Competitive Advantage by Louisa Alameni and Freek Vermeulen. In recent years, many companies have been sensitized to the value of diversity, equity, and inclusion. But in most organizations, DEI initiatives focus largely on gender and ethnicity. A group that has received less attention is people with disabilities, and that has led to disparities in the workplace. In the United Kingdom, for example, the employment rate for people with some form of disability, who make up 20% of the working age population, is just 53%, far less than the 81% rate for people without disabilities. Employing people with disabilities is usually seen as a social cause, one best suited to organizations that are not-for-profit or in the public sector. That is a mistake, and more important, a missed opportunity. In many industries, innovative companies are showing that the inclusion of people with disabilities can lead to real competitive advantage and long-term profitability. Our research suggests that having employees with disabilities in its workforce can build a firm's competitive advantage in four ways. One, disabilities often confer unique talents that make people better at particular jobs. Two, the presence of employees with disabilities elevates the culture of the entire organization, making it more collaborative and boosting productivity. Three, a reputation for inclusiveness enhances a firm's value proposition with customers who become more willing to build long-term relationships with the company. Four, Being recognized as socially responsible gives a firm an edge in the competition for capital and talent. Let's look at each of these advantages in turn. Special abilities. Distinctive and unusual skills frequently go hand in hand with disabilities. For instance, academics who study autism, notably Cambridge University's Simon Baron-Cohen, have found strong links between autism and aptitude at tasks requiring attention to detail. Managers at the international IT consultancy Audicon, which offers quality assurance and testing, report that their autistic consultants are often especially adept at recognizing patterns, which makes them better than others at seeing correlations and interdependencies in large amounts of data. Moreover, they can often stay focused for unusually long periods of time, even when doing work that is routine and repetitive. Famously, the British Intelligence Service enlisted Alan Turing, who, as one study concluded, was most likely on the autism spectrum, to help crack the code produced by the German Enigma machine during the Second World War. A brilliant mathematician who was generally considered the founding father of computer science, Turing later would become one of the pioneers of artificial intelligence. Recently, major corporations like SAP, HP, and EY have been recruiting neurodiverse employees for specific tasks like quality control, cybersecurity, and code checking. And the British Intelligence Service still hires them too. Its Government Communications Headquarters unit enlists relatively large numbers of people with dyslexia to analyze surveillance data because they're unusually good at spotting anomalies that others miss. Dyslexia and autism aren't the only disabilities linked with special talents. Consider the Gran Estacion shopping mall in Bogota, Colombia, which employs many people with physical disabilities in a variety of roles. For example, customer relations. People who want to meet with someone in customer service are often upset and angry. Disabled employees seem better able to diffuse such emotions, according to the mall's general manager. One customer service rep who was in a wheelchair told us, "As soon as they see me coming in, they calm down." Her disability has proved to be an advantage in her line of work. In some jobs, aspects of a person's disability may actually be a good fit with the tasks at hand. At Gran Estacion, the team working in elevator shafts, which often can be very noisy, consists largely of deaf people. The mall outsources security to a company called Seguridad Burns de Colombia, now part of the multinational Securitas, which hires disabled people to work as security officers. A common problem in the mall is pickpocketing, particularly when it's crowded. As the managers at Gran Estacion explained to us, guards in wheelchairs are significantly better at spotting these crimes because they have better visibility at pocket height. What's more, when they need to rush to a scene or chase a perpetrator, they can move faster than people on foot, and many have superior upper body strength, which helps them restrain thieves. Since 2007, Securitas has been introducing the concept of wheelchair security guards at many customers across Latin America. Examples abound of companies around the globe seeking out people with disabilities for specific tasks. In Spain, for instance, the design studio La Casa de Carlota puts people with intellectual disabilities, such as Down syndrome, and with autism on all its project teams because, as its creative director says, these guys create details that are completely authentic and original. The private health insurance company, DKV, employs only people with disabilities in its DKV Integralia call center because it found that satisfaction was much higher among customers helped by employees with disabilities. even though the callers didn't know that they were talking with disabled people. The center's general manager says these employees show exceptional levels of empathy and try to solve the problem as if they were helping someone from their own family. The point is not that a disability is often an advantage, but that with various types of jobs, probably more than most employers realize, certain types of disability may suit the work requirements. Organizational culture. In many companies we studied, employees consistently told us that working with disabled people fostered a more collaborative culture. Not only is such a culture a recognized source of competitive advantage, but it's also difficult for rivals to imitate, which is why many businesses invest considerable resources and effort in trying to build one. The challenge in nurturing a sense of community is overcoming people's tendency to compete for status and recognition. Employing people with disabilities, however, can mitigate it. Because they may need active support and assistance with certain things, working with them can inspire their colleagues to develop more cooperative habits and attitudes. Employees at the La Trappe Brewery in the Netherlands, which hires people with disabilities for its production and hospitality teams, explained to us that having disabled colleagues made them realize the importance of helping one another out and being aware of one another's needs and abilities. In addition, it let them see that it's acceptable and even desirable to ask for help themselves. It gives us something special in the workplace, the former executive of the brewery, Thies Thiessen, told us. To investigate whether employers of people with disabilities in general saw a positive effect on their culture, we worked with AESE, the Spanish Association of Supported Employment, which helps people with disabilities find and maintain jobs. Through it, we surveyed HR executives at 57 companies that had hired one or more people with disabilities about their experiences with those workers and about the effect they had on the organization as a whole. No fewer than 88% of the HR professionals agreed that the internal culture of the firms had improved significantly since they had hired employees with disabilities, with 70% in strong agreement. We then decided to dig a bit deeper into what that positive culture change involved. We provided the HR executives with a definition of psychological safety, a concept developed by Harvard Business School professor Amy Edmondson. The belief that within a team, people can ask for help and share ideas, concerns, or feelings without risk of suffering adverse consequences like being punished or humiliated. When we asked the HR professionals about changes in psychological safety at their firms, 65% indicated that it had increased since the hiring of employees with disabilities. What's more, 74% observed that their teams had begun to work better together, and 75% indicated that the hires had enhanced the general atmosphere in their organization. One respondent commented that having a disabled colleague on a team immediately improves team cohesion and creates new routines for collaboration. Another said, "Ever since a person with an intellectual disability started working in the company, all of us have behaved in a more humane way." Our case studies also suggest that colleagues of people with disabilities don't learn just to be more accepting of one another's limitations. Seeing coworkers with disabilities succeed can inspire other employees and make them realize that they too can elevate their performance. The HR director of Gran Estación observes, "The person who is next to the person with a disability gets motivated because he realizes that if someone with difficulties has such good performance, then someone who hasn't got them also should be able to deliver it." All of this results in high levels of employee engagement. Thiessen told us that La Trappe's employee attrition rate and absenteeism have fallen to all-time lows. People didn't want to leave the company and hardly ever called in sick. Other companies in our study had similar experiences. 20 of the 57 firms that we surveyed reported a decline in absenteeism after their companies had started hiring people with disabilities. Market appeal. The employment of disabled people can be a significant part of a company's value proposition to customers. Consider the large, successful Dutch coffee chain, Brownies and Downies, B&D. It offers high-quality hot beverages and sandwiches at competitive prices in prime locations, just like its rivals, Bagels and Beans and Starbucks. Yet there is one difference. Many of B&D's employees have Down syndrome. That difference defines the company's marketing strategy. B&D avoids high-traffic locations like train stations and business districts where many customers just want a quick coffee. Instead, it focuses on places where people can sit down quietly and relax. Having people with disabilities prepare and serve the products may at times make the service a little slower, but it is one of the reasons some customers like to visit the chain. Indeed, we know from research that customers value not just the content of a product and its functionality, but also how it is produced and by whom. To further explore how people with disabilities help firms strengthen their appeal, we set up a series of experiments enlisting 200 individuals as participants. Half of them were asked to consider purchasing a customized mug online from a company that had received high ratings from its customers. The other half were asked the same thing, but were also told that the company employed many people with disabilities. We then analyzed people's willingness to pay for the mug. The fact that the company employed people with disabilities by itself didn't increase people's inclination to pay more for the mug. So we repeated the experiment with another group of 200 participants who were asked to consider buying an engraved necklace. We found much the same result. The participants weren't willing to pay more or less for something that was produced by a company that employed disabled people. They also didn't rate the quality of the product any higher. However, in both cases, we also tested for general attitudes toward the company. Did people feel they liked the company? Did they perceive what in marketing is called a communal relationship with it, in the sense that they would like to see the company succeed, felt happy if it performed well, and were willing to actively support it? If the company employed people with disabilities, the answer was yes. Customers were significantly more likely to engage in a communal relationship with it than they were with a company in the control group. Interestingly, our results clearly indicated that people's willingness to pay was significantly higher for a company that they liked and felt a communal relationship with. So, even though customers are not willing to pay more for a product or a service just because the seller employs people with disabilities, there is not a simple direct relationship. They are willing to pay more for a product or service if they feel a psychological bond with a company. And that bond is much more likely to form if a firm is known to have disabled employees. Thus, there is a strong indirect positive effect on people's willingness to pay for a product or service. We also found some indication that customers would be more likely to make repeat purchases from the company. In another follow-up experiment, this time analyzing 177 new respondents' inclination to buy and willingness to pay more for a backpack, we examined why people feel a stronger relationship with a company that employs people with disabilities. Analyzing different potential motives, we found that it's because they perceive such a company to be more fair, for example, in its pricing, and because they feel that they're being helpful themselves by purchasing its product or service. It made them feel good about themselves, which can be a powerful and persuasive addition to any firm's value proposition. So the general attitude of the public toward a company becomes more positive and supportive if it employs people with disabilities, which down the line significantly enhances the inclination to purchase from it, become a long-term customer, and pay more for its offering. A related study by David Dwortman of Rutgers University and several colleagues also points to positive connections. When they analyzed the attitudes of customers in a group of supermarkets in Lithuania who had been served by workers who were in wheelchairs or had a hearing impairment, they found that employing people with disabilities enhanced the reputation of the firm, making it viewed as more socially responsible. These findings, however, do present some challenges for companies. If people value how something is produced and by whom, it implies that the company needs to show and communicate to customers about whom it employs. With a coffee chain, that's easy, because the servers can be directly observed by customers. But with, for example, a factory, it will require a lot more thought. Take the successful Spanish cooperative La Fagata, which runs a dairy farm and a gardening business and is well known for its high-quality yogurt. It employs several hundred people who have intellectual disabilities or suffer from mental illness, many of whom might otherwise be in psychiatric hospitals, paying them standard salaries. By buying the cooperative's products and services, customers will help those people have productive and meaningful lives. However, supermarket consumers may not know about La Fagata's workers. To address the problem, the cooperative opened a visitor center, which, given its location in an area of natural beauty, attracts more than 40,000 visitors a year. "This is the best marketing we have," commented founder Cristobal Colon. "People go away not just liking the yogurt, but also after seeing the forest, the cows listening to their music, and the workers doing their jobs as apostles. People develop an emotional connection with the La Fagata brand." Similarly, La Trappe, which is located on the grounds of a Trappist monastery, opened a tasting room on its premises that attracts more than 125,000 visitors a year. When they tour the brewery and taste its beer, they see the employees with disabilities at work. As La Trappe's marketing director explained to us, they become real fans and tell all their friends and family about it. Employing people with disabilities isn't a substitute for good products or fine customer service, but it adds another dimension to a company's value proposition, which can help differentiate it in a crowded market. It's important, though, to be genuine about it, rather than, for instance, recruit only a small number of employees with disabilities for PR purposes. If customers sense that the practice is not genuine and not really spread throughout the firm, it may not only be ineffective, but even backfire. It could make them feel angry and manipulated and perceive the company as being exploitive rather than benevolent. When hiring people with disabilities is implemented sincerely, however, it can generate another positive knock-on effect, attracting customers with disabilities and their family members, who form a considerable economic segment themselves. The managers of Gran Estacion noticed that once they started hiring many people with disabilities, particularly in visible functions such as security and information services, the number of disabled customers began to increase substantially. We ourselves have observed many families with disabled children in the mall. According to Andrea Hernandez, its coordinator of human resources, this is because they feel more at home in Gran Estacion, which also makes them more likely to be return customers. Access to capital and talent. Hiring people with disabilities can give companies an advantage with key stakeholders besides customers. Take the market for capital. Investing the target's ventures focused on environmental, social, and governance, ESG, issues has increased rapidly in the past several years. Bloomberg estimates that ESG-related assets topped $41 trillion in 2022 and will reach $50 trillion by 2025. According to CNBC, the assets of impact investing index funds quadrupled from 2017 to 2020 and now compose 20% of the U.S. market. Employing people with disabilities makes a company more attractive to such investors. In Europe, venture capitalists have started taking ESG factors into account in their investment decisions, and a growing number of social impact funds are looking to put considerable sums into socially responsible startups. Employee diversity is an increasingly relevant consideration in those decisions. The European Venture Philanthropy Association, for example, reported in its Investing for Impact survey that 36% of the investment focus of beneficiaries related to people with disabilities. People with disabilities also are an untapped source of talent. They may not always be very skilled at the traditional process of finding and applying for jobs or at interviewing, but those skills may not correlate at all with the requirements of the jobs involved. Prejudice often deters employers from hiring people with disabilities, but that means it's easier for more enlightened companies to snap up highly skilled people. In the United Kingdom, for example, high school graduates with disabilities are no more likely to have a job than people who left school before graduating, suggesting that there are many qualified disabled people available for employment. Oticon, for instance, has hired several with STEM PhDs for data service and analytics jobs who at the time were working as couriers and delivering pizza. Moreover, hiring people with disabilities makes a company more likely to be seen as an attractive employer for people without disabilities. We saw this in an experiment we ran, which involved a simulated potential employer, a global firm with about 3,000 employees in financial services. We provided information on the company to 200 respondents who were different from those in our previous experiments. With half of them, we mentioned that the firm had employees with a disability, but with the other half, we did not. The results revealed that if a considerable proportion of employees at the company had a disability, job seekers liked the company much more, were substantially more interested in working for it, and thought they would simply be happier there. They even indicated that they would be willing to forgo a higher salary from another firm to join the company. That corroborates prior findings that having a positive impact on society is increasingly critical in the labor market. Recent surveys by Gallup and Deloitte, for instance, consistently indicate that particularly for millennials, whether a company behaves in a socially responsible manner is an important criterion in choosing an employer. Like employees and investors, other stakeholders, such as advertisers, unions, and alliance partners, are likely to value the employment of people with disabilities. For instance, it helps the coffee chain B&D attract franchisees. Employing people with disabilities is a worthy cause, but portraying it as such masks the fact that it can deliver real benefits to organizations. When Andrea Ghirlanda, the CEO of Oticon, sent his customary note thanking one of the firm's large clients, the head of data analytics at a multinational pharmaceutical company, for making a difference in the lives of disabled people, he received a swift but concise reply. "Stop thanking me. I'm not doing this from the kindness of my heart. Your consultants are great. We're doing things so much better than before." The creative director of La Casa de Carlotta holds a similar view. "Lots of people think that we're being kind by working with people who have autism or Down syndrome. But I don't feel like I'm being kind. I feel like I'm being clever," the director says. "I'm tapping into their unique form of creativity, which hasn't been used to its full potential in the creative industries up till now. There's nothing wrong with wanting to do good in the world, but there's also nothing wrong with wanting to do well. and the latter is enough reason to employ people with disabilities. Well, next time we'll feature another article highlighting the value of people with disabilities in the workplace. At this point, let me remind you that you're listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, John Curry. Our next piece comes from PBS News. It's entitled, Inventor Louis Braille Touched Lives with Literacy, by Dr. Howard Markle. Few inventors have had such a positive effect on so many lives as Louis Braille, the remarkable educator, innovator, and advocate for the blind. Braille was born about 20 miles east of Paris in Couperet, France, on January 4, 1809. As a boy of three, Louis was playing at his father's leather workbench with a sharp cobbler's tool when he poked one of his own eyes, causing severe damage. Like the great American humorist James Thurber, Braille's other eye became inflamed and he developed sympathetic ophthalmia, whereby both the physical wound to one eye and the sympathetic inflammation of the other caused him to completely lose his sight by the age of five. At 10, Braille was awarded a scholarship to France's prestigious, if poorly resourced, Royal Institute for Blind Youth in Paris. He excelled in his classes and became a wonderfully talented organist and cellist, as well as a kind mentor for the junior students. Braille first encountered an early predecessor to his tactile writing system in 1821 while he was still an adolescent. Charles Barbier, a former French military officer, had developed a code that soldiers could use to send and read messages in the dark, and he shared his method with the Institute. Braille began to adapt the idea into his own refined version, eventually creating his remarkable system of specific bumpy dot patterns embossed onto thick pages of paper, with each symbol representing a letter in the alphabet or numbers and other symbols. In 1829, he published his landmark book, Method of Writing Words, Music, and Plain Songs by Means of Dots for Use by the Blind and Arranged for Them, a musical code for blind musicians. He also wrote guides for the blind on mathematics, geometrical figures, maps, and musical symbols. After graduation, Braille was asked to stay at the Royal Institute as an instructor, and by 1833 was promoted to professor. But Braille's system was not formally adopted by the Royal Institute until 1854, 2 years after Braille died. The system soon became the method of choice among blind French speakers, and by the 1880s had spread to virtually every school for the blind in the world. Today, Braille remains a major form of communication, not only for book publishing, but also on computer terminals, in buildings, and for email, mathematical, and scientific notation. Braille was never the paragon of health. He developed tuberculosis as a young man, and, in true consumptive manner, it spread throughout his lungs, making the last 16 years of his life quite difficult. At age 40, he had to retire. He died on January 6th at age 43 and was buried in the Pantheon among so many of France's heroes. This vanguard teacher offered edification and access to information and creativity to the visually impaired. Braille's profile has graced postage stamps, medals, and coins. His life story told in books, movies, plays, and songs. In a 1952 essay, poet T.S. Eliot reflected that perhaps the most enduring honor to the memory of Louis Braille is the half-conscious honor we pay him by applying his name to the script he invented. His memory has, in this way, a security greater than that of the memories of many men more famous in their day. And now from the Disability Scoop, an article entitled "Trump Faces Backlash for Calling Harris Mentally Disabled" by Michelle Diament. Disability advocates and members of both political parties are calling out former President Donald Trump after he described Vice President Kamala Harris as mentally impaired and mentally disabled. Trump made the comments at a rally in Wisconsin on Saturday and reiterated the personal attacks while campaigning in Pennsylvania on Sunday. "Joe Biden became mentally impaired," the former president said. "Kamala was born that way." If you think about it, only a mentally disabled person could have allowed this to happen to our country, Trump continued, in an effort to tie Harris to the current administration's border policies. Maria Towne, president and CEO of the nonpartisan American Association of People with Disabilities, blasted Trump's rhetoric for perpetuating stereotypes and being dismissive of the millions of voters with disabilities. "Trump holds the ableist false belief that if a person has a disability, they are less human and less worthy of dignity. These perceptions are incorrect and are harmful to people with disabilities," Towne said, noting that many former presidents dating back to George Washington have had disabilities. "To be clear, the insult of Donald Trump's comment is not the suggestion that Vice President Harris is disabled, but rather the insinuation that having a disability is synonymous with poor performance as a prospective president," she said. Fellow Republicans quickly sought to distance themselves from Trump's remarks. "I think that's insulting, not only to the vice president, but to people who actually do have mental disabilities," Larry Hogan, a former Republican governor of Maryland who is running for Senate, told CBS. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican South Carolina, said during an appearance on CNN that Trump should take a different approach. "I just think the better course to take is to prosecute the case that her policies are destroying the country," Graham said. Meanwhile, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat, said that Trump turns to name-calling because he doesn't have anything good to offer everyday people. "I think whenever he says things like that, he's talking about himself, but trying to project it onto others," Pritzker said. Next is another piece by Michelle Diament, this one entitled "Senate Punts on Autism Act." Lawmakers approved a short-term extension of the nation's primary autism law, but the path to renewing the measure, which includes nearly $2 billion for the developmental disability, could be rockier than expected. Disability advocates have been pushing Congress for months to renew the law, known as the Autism Collaboration, Accountability, Research, Education, and Support, or Autism Cares Act, before it expired at the end of September. The U.S. House of Representatives voted to re-up the measure, but the Senate failed to act. Rather than let the law sunset, however, Congress included an extension of the Autism Cares Act in a broad, short-term spending bill signed into law last week to avert a government shutdown. The measure will maintain funding for federal programs, including those authorized by the Autism Cares Act, through December 20. Now, it's expected that further consideration of the autism law will wait until Congress reconvenes after the November election, and it's unclear how things will play out at that point. Disability advocates say that Senator Rand Paul, Republican Kentucky, and possibly one other senator have placed a hold on the autism bill. A hold offers lawmakers the opportunity to prevent a vote while they discuss their issues with a particular piece of legislation. It's not known what concerns prompted the Senate hold, and representatives for Paul did not respond to questions about the matter. We are concerned about the holds and hope that they can be overcome when the Senate returns in November, said Kim Muschino, Vice President of Public Safety at the Autism Society of America. Of course, we wish it had passed before the Senate recessed. However, the law has such strong and overwhelming bipartisan support, I think it will ultimately prevail. The version of the Autism CARES Act that passed the House last month would allocate more than $1.95 billion over the next 5 years for research, prevalence tracking, screening, professional training, and other governmental activities related to autism. In addition to extending many provisions of the existing Autism CARES Act, the new bill would direct the National Institutes of Health to ensure that research reflects the full range of cognitive, communicative, behavioral, and adaptive functioning needs of those on the spectrum. The legislation calls for an increase in the number of NIH centers of excellence, and it would require the NIH to produce an annual budget plan for autism research, and it includes efforts to promote the adoption of assistive communication. What's more, the bill would require a governmental report on ways to increase the number of developmental behavioral pediatricians, and another looking at youth aging out of school. Going forward, advocates say they are working to make sure the law, which enjoys broad bipartisan support, doesn't hit more bumps later this year. While the Senate's early adjournment includes a temporary extension of programs under the Autism CARES Act, protecting the autism community from disruption of essential initiatives, whether the 1 in 36 autistic children and 1 in 45 adults in the U.S. will continue to receive care and support for a diverse range of evolving needs is dependent on what happens when the Senate reconvenes in November, said Stuart Spielman, Senior Vice President of Advocacy at Autism Speaks. The authorization and appropriation for autism activities around developmental disabilities, surveillance and research, autism training, early detection and intervention, and the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee has not lapsed, but now is the time for advocates to make their voices heard, encouraging their senators to ensure the Autism CARES Act before its new expiration date in December. Next up is a piece from the Braille Monitor entitled, "It Matters What We Do, Not Who We Are," by Gerard J. Vermeij. From the editor. When I see something from Dr. Vermeij, I know with certainty that I will be called upon to think, and when I share his articles, I know the same is true for others. In this particular issue, we have this article, which clearly expresses the view that we put much too much energy into identity rather than focusing on what we can do and letting that become the positive that defines us. I think one of the purposes of the Braille Monitor is to get people to think about divergent points of view and then synthesizing them into something that makes each of us more successful than we would have been without the perspectives we have considered and absorbed. Here's the article. Modern society seems obsessed with identity, race, gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, and disability. They all take center stage in defining us as individuals. At every turn, we are asked to identify ourselves according to society's currently fashionable categories, regardless of whether those categories can be unambiguously circumscribed. Thousands of sociological studies, government mandates, and policies at every level of society are founded on heterogeneous, ill-defined, and often highly fluid categories. Worse, these categories reinforce existing prejudices and biases. Those of us who are blind know all of this very well. Yet, even we often fall into this preoccupation with identity. In his 1963 speech, "Blindness, Handicap, or Characteristic," reprinted in the Braille Monitor, Volume 66, Number 6, June 2023, Kenneth Jernigan correctly asserted that blindness is a characteristic, one of many traits that affect a person's life. With great clarity, he argued that blindness can be mitigated so that it need not and should not be considered a sign of inability or inferiority. Indeed, a core mission of the National Federation of the Blind is to ensure that blind individuals have the tools as well as the positive attitudes to overcome the physical and social disadvantages that come with blindness. This necessary work continues as it should. But I would go a step further. Our characteristics, including blindness, do influence what we do and how others perceive us, but they do not define us. What matters, it seems to me, is what we do, not who we are. Society's preoccupation with identity is destructive. It reinforces stereotypes and prematurely determines the potential, or lack of potential, for individual accomplishments and diminishes the fairness of how the actions and contributions of individuals are judged. My perspective on this issue derives not from social activism or advocacy, but from my lifelong study of the economic history of the world of living things, including our own species. Life forms today and in the past have managed to persevere and, in the long run, to improve in a world full of changing challenges and opportunities. In my latest book, The Evolution of Power, A New Understanding of the History of Life, Princeton University Press, 2023, I explore the premise that, like humans, all other forms of life have the ability to change and adapt to their surroundings to the extent that their power, the rate at which energy and material resources are acquired and deployed, allows. Although their station in the web of life is strongly affected by this power, it is the actions of living things that matter. By itself, power or energy, like money, means nothing. They become useful only when they are developed to do something. In other words, characteristics in the abstract tell us nothing about what we do. A shift in emphasis away from identity toward accomplishment would represent a healthy and refreshing reorientation in how we and others see ourselves. What can we do with the appropriate physical and educational tools? Isn't it better to be evaluated on what we have done or are doing than to be classified according to preconceived, often socially loaded, categories based on characteristics in isolation? Our accomplishments and actions are far more diverse than our socially prescribed characteristics, and it is this diversity of doing that describes the richness of the human enterprise. Our next article comes from the Disability Scoop, and it is entitled Study Bolsters Evidence That Autism Runs in Families by Sean Heasley. Siblings of children with autism are about 7 times more likely than others to have the developmental disability too, new research suggests. In a study looking at more than 1,600 children who had older siblings with autism, researchers found that 20.2% also qualified for a diagnosis by the time they were age 3. The risk was even higher, rising to almost 37% in children with multiple siblings on the spectrum. The odds also varied based on the sex of the first child with autism in a family. If a family's first autistic child was a girl, they were 50% more likely to have another child with autism than if their first autistic child was a boy, said Sally Ozanoff of the UC Davis Mind Institute, who led the study. This points to genetic differences that increase recurrence likelihood in families who have an autistic daughter. There were also differences in recurrence rates based on race and the mother's level of education, with higher odds seen in non-white families and in moms with less schooling. The findings, which were published recently in the journal Pediatrics, are based on data collected from children in the U.S., Canada, and the United Kingdom, who were evaluated by autism experts multiple times between 6 months and 3 years of age. The study is a follow-up to one released in 2011, which found that the recurrence rate in families that already had a child with autism was 18.7%. The latest study comes as autism rates have continued to climb in the last decade, and it also included a much larger and more diverse group of families than the initial effort. So now we have two large independent studies that report familial recurrence in the same range, Ozanoff said. This reinforces how important it is that providers closely monitor the siblings of autistic children for delays in social development or communication. This is especially true in families who have reduced access to care because early diagnosis and intervention are critical. And now a piece from the Arizona Republic entitled Walmart to Pay $100,000 Settlement in Disability Discrimination Case Brought by Arizona Cashier by Miguel Torres. A Walmart in Bullhead City on Monday settled a disability case for $100,000 and was placed under a court order to improve its treatment of employees after firing a cashier with epilepsy, according to the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Stevie Wyman was fired on December 1, 2017, after an assistant store manager in the Arizona store told her that she had an excessive number of absences related to her epilepsy, according to court records. Walmart had a policy accommodating Wyman's absences due to epileptic seizures. But in October 2017, the corporate office informed managers in Bullhead City that Wyman's doctor-approved absences would no longer be covered, leading to her absences counting against her, according to court records. Due to its failure to work with Wyman and provide reasonable accommodations after its decision to no longer excuse her medical absences, the court placed the Bullhead City Walmart under a consent decree. Wyman came to a settlement with Walmart for $100,000, according to a statement by the Federal Employment Commission. Under the consent decree, a monitor will ensure that the Bullhead City Walmart implements training, maintains records, and submits reports for the next 2 years. All costs associated with the monitoring, training, and compliance will be borne by Walmart. If Walmart violates the consent decree, the court can impose appropriate relief, which may include fines, additional monitoring, or other corrective actions. Federal law requires employers to provide reasonable accommodations so that employees with disabilities can do their jobs, said Mary Jo O'Neill, regional attorney for the Federal Commission's Phoenix District. That brings our program to a close. We appreciate you joining us for the disability news on Sun Sounds of Arizona. We hope you continue to tune in to Sun Sounds and enjoy the many, many wonderful programs.